is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. A young man shot a Russian military commander at close range at an enlistment office on Monday. It was an unusually bold attack reflecting growing resistance to Russian President Vladimir Putin's efforts to mobilize hundreds of thousands of more men to wage war on Ukraine. That shooting comes after scattered arson attacks on enlistment offices and protests in Russian cities that resulted in at least 2,000 arrests. Russia is seeking to bolster its military as its Ukraine offensive has bogged down. Concerns are growing that Russia may escalate the conflict, including potentially using nuclear weapons. Votes are being held, meanwhile, in four occupied Ukraine regions about joining up with Russia. Britain's foreign secretary called the votes sham referendums held at the barrel of a gun. Authorities say that a gunman killed 17 people and wounded 24 others in a school in central Russia. That's according to officials there. That 11 children were among those killed in the Monday morning shooting in the school number 88 in a city about 960 kilometers or 600 miles east of Moscow. The governor of the region said that the gunman killed himself after that attack. Russia's investigative committee identified the gunman as 34-year-old Artyom Kazanov, a graduate of the school. And the governor said that he was a patient at a psychiatric facility. He used two non-lethal handguns adapted to fire real bullets. An investigation has been launched on multiple murder charges. There is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his counterpart from Pakistan have discussed relations and devastating flooding in Pakistan. AP correspondent Norman Hall.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken met at the State Department with his Pakistani counterpart, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. Besides 75 years of relations, the two leaders also discussed cataclysmic flooding. A third of Pakistan remains submerged from being inundated most of the summer.
We have experienced a climate catastrophe of biblical apocalyptic proportions. It rained and rained and rained and rained and rained from mid-June till the end of August.
Secretary Blinken says the U.S. immediate response so far tops $50 million and 17 plane loads of emergency supplies, including food and tarps. Norman Hall, Washington.
A NASA spacecraft rammed an air asteroid Monday night in a test to see if space rocks could be knocked out of a collision course with the Earth. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has more on that story.
The DART spacecraft, launched last November, rammed an asteroid at 14,000 miles an hour in an effort to nudge the space rock into a smaller orbit around its twin, 7 million miles from Earth.
And we have impact. A giant leap for humanity.
Mission controller Elena Adams, as the DART's camera went blank and its signal abruptly ended. Data from a bevy of telescopes trained on the pair will be checked to see if the orbit has shifted. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson says the mission is just the start of protecting the Earth from asteroids like the one thought to have led to the mass extinction of the dinosaurs 66 million years ago.
Planetary defense is a global endeavor.
I'm Tim McGuire.
Pfizer is asking the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to expand use of its updated COVID-19 booster to younger children. AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
Since they were rolled out earlier this month for those 12 and older, some 4.4 million Americans have received one of the updated Omicron-focused boosters. Now Pfizer wants to offer a child-sized dose for children ages 5 to 11. As with Pfizer's original vaccine, the elementary school-aged children would get a third of the dose of the updated booster. An FDA decision is expected soon. Pfizer and its partner BioNTech also announced they've begun a study of the updated booster in children younger than 5. I'm Ben Thomas.
And recapping our top story, a young man shot a Russian military commander at close range at an enlistment office on Monday. And the shooting comes after scattered arson attacks on enlistment offices and protests in Russian cities, resulting in at least 2,000 arrests. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Tuesday, September 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, thousands of fighting men flee Russia over partial mobilization as Kyiv rejects referendum on occupied territories.
Ukraine would definitely not recognize these referendums, as President Zelensky mentioned once again that this would end any possibility for negotiation with Russia.
Tensions in the Korean Peninsula threatens to overshadow the state funeral of former Japanese Prime Minister.
It's not surprising that there was a missile launch around the time of Vice President Harris's visit to Tokyo and then Seoul. However, as always, we sort of wonder if there's sort of some convenient timing aspect of this planned.
And gunmen kill 17 people, including 11 children, in a school in central Russia. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Five days after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a partial mobilization to call up hundreds of thousands of reservists to fight in Ukraine, the move has triggered outraged protests across Russia, a fearful exodus of men of fighting age from the country, and acts of violence. There have been demonstrations not just in the usual places like Moscow and St. Petersburg, but also in the remote far north province of Yakutia and in the poor southern region of Dagestan. This as Kyiv and the West slams the Kremlin's referendum in occupied cities. Reporter Anna Chernikova updates Flashpoint Ukraine's host Miller on the response to the, quote, referendums, unquote, and fighting along the front lines.
These referendums were quite expected in Ukraine. No one was sure when exactly it will happen. But in general, Ukraine would definitely not recognize these referendums, as President Zelensky mentioned once again that this would end any possibility for negotiation with Russia. He emphasized this in one of his latest speeches once again. Also, President Zelensky said that no matter what happens this week in Russia, no matter what steps Russian forces plans, whether political or military, Ukrainian task cannot change. He said that we are fighting for life and freedom for all Ukrainians, end of quote. So Ukrainian officials, they're highlighting that no matter what happens, Ukraine will continue to fight for its own territory and defend its own territory. Everyone takes very seriously everything that President Putin is saying, because of course, no one can predict exactly what he has on his mind. But again, Ukraine is not planning to stop defending its land because of what President Putin said.
In the time that we have left, I was wondering if you could give us a quick update on where things stand on the battleground. I understand there's been continued fighting in the Zaporizhia region. As you alluded to, there's ongoing counteroffensives in the Kherson region. But what has been reported back to you?
Official information for the moment is that very heavy fightings are happening along the front line. They continue, basically. And for the moment, the total length of this front line is 2,000 kilometers. So heavy fighting is happening in the Donetsk region, still in some parts of the Kharkiv region, of course, Kherson region, as well as Mykolaiv and Zaporizhia region. So these are the main directions for the moment, these five. What we know that President Zelensky confirmed recently that Ukrainian army had a certain success in the Kherson region. He did not give additional details, but we are hearing as well that there are certain successful operations happening in the Kherson region, and everyone is waiting for the official update from the military, so we might get some information soon. If we talk about Zaporizhia and Odessa, these two cities were recently very much under heavy attacks. So if we talk about Zaporizhia, it's shelling, artillery shelling, and there were quite a lot over the past days. For the moment, we know that, for example, yesterday, there were at least 10 attacks, was confirmed by the head of the Zaporizhia region, and it was a massive missile strike on the city. We don't have information on the victims for the moment.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's host Steve Miller from Kyiv. The war in Ukraine has created millions of child refugees and many of Ukraine's 100,000-plus children in the nation's system of orphanages have also been displaced. A group of U.S. scientists is trying to help, Aksinia Tokova reports.
Many orphanages in Ukraine have been forced to close or relocate due to the war, disrupting the lives of children with only staff to watch over them. So a group of U.S. scientists united to help through a project called Earthlings Hub. Volunteers offer the children online science classes to help provide some structure and routine while capturing their interest and imagination. Astrophysicist and former astronaut instructor Julia Brodsky started the project.
When the war started, everyone was shocked for the first few weeks. But then we thought about what children and parents were going through, how important it was for them to feel some kind of normalcy.
Brodsky and her colleagues put the word out that they needed teachers who could fascinate orphaned children with science lessons, and in the process give orphanage staff a much-needed break. Teacher Alexander Kaurov stepped up to help.
I was teaching a course where we pretended to travel in time and tried to make scientific discoveries using some materials at hand. It's hardly a traditional school course, but you can pack many interesting things in there.
Together with four of her colleagues and 106 children under their care, orphanage teacher Irina Shramko fled from Ukraine to Poland. Shramko says the online classes have been a huge help.
We are with kids all the time. We're responsible for their lives and well-being, even when they're having online classes with U.S. teachers. But we can take a breath, sit in silence, get a little distracted. It's such a relief.
Project workers say teachers from other countries are also lining up to join the Earthlings Hub team, including from the UK, Germany, and Australia. Teachers benefit too, according to Halina Furdiga, a principal in the Ukrainian city of Chernivtsi.
It's a different approach to teaching math than we had in our school. It's interesting for everyone, including our teachers. They take part in classes and I'm sure will borrow ideas.
Officials say so far the biggest issue is the lack of computers. Donors have provided 300 laptops to children in Poland, but with so many displaced children, they say many more are needed. Ksenia Trukova for VOA News.
Tensions in the Korean Peninsula threaten to overshadow the state funeral of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. This after North Korea fired its 20th missile launch this year to coincide with the arrival of U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris to the region. Harris is leading a delegation to Abe's funeral, after which she will visit Seoul amid a military exercise between Washington and South Korea. North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations, Kim Sung, on Monday, in an address to the United Nations General Assembly, said Pyongyang was caught in a, quote, vicious circle of tension and confrontation due to the growing hostility of the United States and its following forces against the DPRK, unquote. For more, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
North Korea has fired a lot of rockets this year. In fact, it's fired more than it ever has in any other year. So just by nature of that fact, I think that it's not surprising that there was a missile launch around the time of Vice President Harris's visit to Tokyo and then Seoul. However, as always, we sort of wonder if there's sort of some convenient timing aspect of this planned. Of course, Harris is not the only person who's visiting Tokyo. You're seeing actually hundreds of foreign dignitaries visiting Japan for the state funeral of Abe. There is some conversation about the issue. I would say it's not dominating, but there is sort of long-term sort of worries about the direction of where tensions with North Korea are going. There are concerns that it will conduct a nuclear test, that it will continue testing these missiles and challenging the U.S. and its allies.
What about the funeral of former Prime Minister Abe? There have been concerns, even among Japanese, that the government is spending so much money for that.
So it's actually an interesting decision to hold the state funeral months after his death. Abe, of course, was assassinated in July. They're just now holding the state funeral for him. And since that period, during that period, there's been something of a sort of public backlash against the idea of a funeral. It's complicated. I mean, Abe is obviously respected here. He was the country's longest serving prime minister. He brought security and stability to the country in a very difficult time. However, there is criticism that perhaps the government is spending too much money on this funeral. It's going to cost around $11 million. State funerals in Japan are usually only held for the emperor and his family, so this is a bit unusual. And then there are concerns that many have about giving this honor to a man who was quite divisive at home. Overseas, Abe was sort of lauded as this person who sort of supported and helped maintain the international order, and he had lots of friends overseas. But at home, I think like in any country, domestic politics is tricky, and so lots of people here were opposed to his policies. We've even seen protests against the idea of holding an Abe state funeral, and some of those protests were quite large.
That's VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from Tokyo. UN investigators report Venezuela's military and civilian intelligence agencies play a key role in repressing dissent through violent means to keep President Nicolas Maduro in power. The independent fact-finding mission into Venezuela submitted its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Investigators say the two agencies are part of a well-coordinated structure. They say it was created to retain Maduro's grip on power by keeping the civilian population in check through a policy of fear and intimidation. It says many of the brutal tactics employed by the Military Intelligence Service, known as DGCIM, and the civilian intelligence agency, SABIN, could amount to crimes against humanity. The report documents grave human rights violations committed by both agencies. These include allegations of torture and other ill treatment, sexual and gender-based violence, arbitrary detention, and enforced disappearance. Chair of the fact-finding mission, Marta Valinas, says the mission has gathered evidence proving these crimes were not committed by individuals who had no connection with these agencies. She speaks through an interpreter.
Quite the reverse. The DGCIM and SABIN are part of machinery which is put in place and deployed for the execution of a government plan which aims to repress those it perceives to be its opponents and to consolidate thereby its control of power. Its plan was therefore orchestrated from the highest political levels.
Valina says human rights violations by both agencies continue until now. The mission also focused on the situation in the mining region, particularly on the state of Bolivar in southern Venezuela. In 1916, the government established the Arco Minero del Orinoco, a national strategic development zone, to extend its control over the gold industry. Valina says the militarization of the region has been progressive since then. She says armed criminal groups openly control mining regions in connivance with the military and trade unionists. She speaks through an interpreter.
Residents of the region have been caught in the crossfire of this violence for the control of gold in the mining regions. State and non-state actors have committed crimes and human rights violations, including murders, enforced disappearances, extortion, corporal punishment, and sexual and gender-based violence. The authorities have not taken sufficient measures to prevent and investigate such abuse.
Venezuela's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Hector Constant Rosales, accuses the investigators of fictionalizing the reality in his country. He says they have invented everything. He rejects the report, calling it politicized. He says it uses unreliable sources, which anyone familiar with what truly is going on in Venezuela will know is fake news. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, authorities say a gunman has killed 17 people and wounded 24 others in a school in central Russia. According to officials, 11 children were among those killed in a morning shooting in school number 88 in Izhevsk, a city 600 miles east of Moscow. The governor of the region said a gunman killed himself after the attack. Russia's investigative committee identified the gunman as 34-year-old Artyom Kazentsev, a graduate of the school, and the governor said he was a patient at a psychiatric facility. He used two non-lethal handguns adapted to fire real bullets. An investigation has been launched on multiple murder charges. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. This week, the White House hosts Pacific Island Nations for the first summit of its kind with the U.S. The meeting comes after a spike in American diplomatic engagement in the region following Beijing's new security pact with Solomon Islands. Jessica Stone has the story.
White House invited a dozen Pacific Island countries, including the leader of the Solomon Islands, for a summit. A first for the strategically vital region now at the heart of the U.S.-China competition.
I am very excited about this Pacific Summit because I really believe it gives an opportunity for us to really build that connection, to see that we are much more alike than different.
Suzanne Varis-Lum leads the East-West Center, which recently hosted Pacific Island leaders to discuss their most urgent challenges, economic development, post-pandemic recovery, and climate change.
There's no time to waste, particularly coming out of COVID-19. There are many needs in the Pacific that need to be heard.
But it's the issue of security that has attracted American diplomatic engagement to the region after Beijing reached a defense pact with the Solomon Islands in May and attempted a wide-ranging agreement with the Pacific Island nations in July. Island leaders have received a steady parade of U.S. officials. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, White House Indo-Pacific Coordinator Kurt Campbell,
the United States will launch the process,
and Vice President Kamala Harris, who joined the Pacific Islands Forum virtually over the summer. Patricia O'Brien of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says since World War II, when the Pacific Islands helped the Allies defeat Japan, there's been a pattern in U.S.-Pacific engagement.
Every time that America has come in any numbers, it has been because that they wanted something out of the Pacific, and then they have left.
O'Brien says to overcome skepticism among Pacific Island leaders, the White House needs to demonstrate that no matter which party is in power in Washington, the Pacific will have partners in their fight against climate change.
Climate knows no boundaries. Fish, IUU, know no boundaries. Neither do currents, neither do the impacts of climate change. So we all need to look at it as one continent, and not as small island nations, but as large ocean economies and nations.
U.S. President Joe Biden recently signed legislation to cut America's greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030. Jessica Stone, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Jessica. UN officials are appealing for urgent action to restore peace and democracy in Myanmar to stop what they call the rot in the country's political system and the rapid deterioration of human rights. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has submitted its latest update on conditions in Myanmar to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Myanmar's human rights situation has been on a downward spiral since the military junta mounted a coup February 1st, 2021. A new report finds military attacks in ethnic regions have increased, with civilians and civilian infrastructure targeted. The UN Human Rights Office reports as many as 30,000 residential buildings, schools, and other civilian infrastructure, and even whole villages have been burned to the ground. Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif says more than 2,300 people, including at least 188 children, have been killed. Additionally, she says more than a million people have fled their homes and are living in precarious conditions. She says they lack food, medical care, and other basic services.
The humanitarian crisis now brings fears of starvation, with the military largely denying humanitarian access, including recent orders to halt humanitarian operations in northern and central Rakhine State. Over 15,607 people have been arrested, with some 12,464 remaining in detention.
She says people in prison are subject to physical abuse, ill treatment, and torture, sometimes resulting in death. She says her office has received information about 111 cases of what appears to be summary executions. She adds the death toll of people in custody is steadily rising. Al-Nashif notes the relative stability experienced in the Rakhine State since the start of the coup has proved short-lived. She says minority communities, especially Rohingya and Kaman Muslims, are particularly vulnerable.
My office has received reports of killings, injuries, arbitrary detention, and mass displacement of civilians resulting from clashes between the Myanmar military and the Arakan army in several townships of Rakhine and Shin State, and along the border with reported cases of shelling into Bangladesh.
More than 700,000 Rohingya fled to Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, in August 2017 to escape discrimination and persecution in Myanmar. Al-Nashif says diplomatic efforts have failed to turn around this catastrophic situation. She says ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, must reinvigorate its efforts to promote a resolution to the crisis. She repeats previous calls to the military to cease violence, to impose a moratorium on executions, and to free all political prisoners. Her appeal, as in the past, has fallen on deaf ears. The UN Acting High Commissioner has received no response from Myanmar's military leaders to her plea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Elections are a cornerstone of the democratic system of government. Attempts to target the U.S. electoral system are an attack on the United States' democratic values. It is therefore no surprise that the U.S. government takes any attempt to undermine or manipulate the American electoral system seriously. The Russian Federation has demonstrated determination in its attempts to undermine the democratic processes and institutions essential to the functioning of our democracy and that of other countries, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. In response, the United States is sanctioning two individuals and four entities that support the Kremlin's global malign influence operations and election interference activities. Alexander Viktorovich Yanov, president and founder of the anti-globalization movement of Russia, uses his position and various companies to promote Russia's disinformation agenda and has worked with Russia's intelligence services to support organizations they believed would create socio-political disturbances in the United States. He is also the president and owner of Yanov Transcontinental and Domain Registrant of the website Stop Imperialism. Yanov was designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for having acted for or on behalf of the government of the Russian Federation. At the same time, the anti-globalization movement of Russia and Yanov Transcontinental were designated under Executive Order 14024 for being owned or controlled by Yanov. Stop Imperialism was also designated under Executive Order 14024 for having acted on behalf of Yanov. Natalia Valerievna Borlinova is the founder and president of the Center for Support and Development of Public Initiative Creative Diplomacy, also known as PCREDI or Creative Diplomacy. Both Borlinova and PCREDI are directly funded and directed by Russia's intelligence services, which also track the career paths and positions of participants in PCREDI-sponsored events. Borlinova was designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for having acted on behalf of the government of the Russian Federation. PCREDI was designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for having acted on behalf of the government of the Russian Federation and for being owned by Borlinova. The Kremlin has repeatedly sought to threaten and undermine our democratic processes and institutions, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson. The United States will continue our extensive work to counter these efforts and safeguard our democracy from Russia's interference.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.